there are overwhelming, turbulent times, but that also means there is major potential to fill the cracks with new ideas and to transform these destructive systems. There are specific root causes for problems and holistic solutions everywhere. There is room for prosperity, there is room for regeneration and a shift in values. Another reality is possible, and that's what we're exploring here today. Welcome to Sage Talking. To talk a little bit about the infamous Club of Rome. I'm sure many people have heard about it before, but since you are a member and that kind of ties into this question, I also have here a sheet of the UN Sustainable Development Goals, which there are 17 of, and they're are a lot of different questions about how do we meet all of them, which ones maybe do not really converge in a way where you can say, okay, maybe we meet one, but then we are getting further from the other. So there are a lot of questions about this. And you mentioned once I watched a talk of yours where you were talking about the smart ways that the Club of Rome scientists developed regarding the UN Sustainable Development Goals. So maybe could you talk first a little bit about the work that the Club of Rome does? What is the purpose for people who've never heard of it before, just quickly as an introduction?
Yes, the Club of Rome was founded 52 years ago by an industrialist, was Aurelio Pecce, who saw that if society continues to operate in this way up until then, that was in 1968, we will eventually potentially run out of natural resources because we're using up the existing resources on the planet faster than the planet could replenish them. And he commissioned four scientists, Harvard scientists, to work on creating a simulation, looking if that was really true. And so that was the result of that research at Harvard, was indeed that if we continued, then we will eventually run out of resources and the planet will be depleted and begin to respond in ways that we may not even envision. And so they warned about climate change and running out of resources and others. So that was the Limits to Growth publication. It was the first publication that came out 50 years ago. Unfortunately, something that cannot be is, you know, or we don't want it to be, is being, you know, fought. And so people fought it tooth and nails, and nothing really happened, not much, other than, oh, these scientists are, you know, envisioning stuff that is not true, and because it didn't fit the economic growth agenda and expansion agenda of many states and several states and so on. And right now it's unfortunately at the point where that turned out to be true in large parts. And so the Club of Rome, several members of the Club of Rome, Jorgen Randers, who is a professor of an emeritus of in the Norwegian Business School, he was one of the original authors of Limits to Growth, and Johan Rockström, the head of the Potsdam Institute, and several others, did additional simulations with existing data that was measured over the past 50 years. We had time to collect data and see what the projection from back then, you know, really happened, you know, over time. And so they saw that we're actually continuing to produce more CO2 that the planet could take, and that leads to global warming and to potential climate catastrophes of many kinds, including ocean levels raising up to several meters, the pole caps melting, and but before all of that, we will see various climate change, the climate change in various parts of the world, and becoming more extreme, more drought and more water, as we see is currently happening. So that's a short story about the Club of Rome. It's a group of academicians, business people, head of states, Gorbachev was member, and others. It's been for 50 years limited to 100. And I was invited to join based on my work on integral investing in using capital and technology to address the planetary, you know, the needs of the planet to go back to a safe environment. And because the term that we're using within this impact of the Anthropocene, which is the human-led economic activity on the planet that produces so much CO2, it's forcing the planet to leave the safe operating system of itself in various areas: biodiversity, water, climate, and nitrogen flows, and so on. So it's a rather complex, it's a very scientific way of looking at and researching the planet. And so at the same time, while the planet is being forced through massive amounts of CO2 emissions as a result of the economic activity on the planet, is responding by it left the operating system. In, you know, there are 9 scientifically identified limits of boundaries that are safe, like a computer. It's an operating system, which is actually an unforgivable comparison. But for people to understand, if your operating system on your computer doesn't work properly, you cannot work on it, and that's the same for the planet. So we left out of the 9 planetary boundaries, we left 5 or 6 of them, you know, the safe environment. So if we then decide as a global society that we want the UN SDGs that you mentioned to be implemented so that everybody participates from the wealth and abundance of the planet, and so the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, we need to make sure that we implement them within the limits of the planetary boundaries. And if you look at how we have been operating over the past 50 years, and if you project that into the future, which the Johan Rockström and Professor Anders did, and within the Stockholm Resilience Center Research Center, they saw that we are not going to implement UN SDGs. So that's basically a long explanation to what you just said. Why? Because the planet is not supporting the current way of doing business as usual. We need to change the way of doing business. Business as usual and is not going to get us there. So the polarization of the society will continue. We will still have up to 2 billion people below the poverty line. Because, you know, our economic system that you just mentioned, you know, the for-profit orientation, our financial systems are set up in a way that, you know, we are extracting money at the expense of everything else, planet and people and the planet. So that will not lead to making the UN SDGs available to everyone on the planet, except if we are making certain adaptations, certain changes. And so this, and those who are interested, who are listening and want to really dig deeper, I highly recommend, first of all, my book, Integral Investing, because in there I go exactly into the details, what, you know, in summary of what, but Transformation is Feasible is a paper that the Club of Rome published. Is a, you know, it's another report to the Club of Rome, just like my book, where they outline what would be a smart way for the next 10 years. We don't have much time left, unfortunately, because the planet is warming up faster than originally thought, because we continue to put CO2 into the atmosphere. And the problem with that is that doesn't leave the planet, it stays there. So even if we stop today to put any additional CO2 into the atmosphere, what we already emitted is already too much.
Yeah, would still continue warming.
Exactly.
Planet, obviously, also because of the feedback cycles
that
exist on the planet. And as you said, I mean, this is a whole conversation then for itself. But I'm also going to link Mariana's book Integral Investing down below in the description. Mariana, now I would love for you to talk a little more about the smart ways how we can kind of implement the UN Sustainable Development Goals.
Science, and I'm a scientist, says, and scientific research makes the recommendation to change our business as usual by having five intentions, five directions. Number one, making sure that we provide the energy, in sustainable ways. So renewable energies instead of getting the oil out of the planet and so on and putting it into the atmosphere. So provide people with the energy, because energy is the foundation of everything, you know, cultural evolution and everything, abundance and so on. So renewable energy and all the investments should go into creating, renewable energy sources for everybody on the planet. And it can be done. The sun shines around, all the time. So it's, and the technology is so cheap that it's actually financially totally viable. And it's much more viable to create renewable energy than, through fossil fuels. So number one. Number two is addressing inequality, making sure that as we currently have that 40% of the wealth is not owned by 10% of the people on the planet. And of course, redistribution is important, so, making sure that nobody is left behind. Number three is supporting developing countries to continue to develop using sustainable ways of development, which we know how to do. In that way, not to leave people behind, pick up everybody in Africa and around the world. We know how China has managed to raise 30 million people out of poverty over the past 30 years, so we know how to do. And my favorite is basically education, family planning, and empowering girls' education, and healthcare. So make sure that people are provided with healthcare. And so I'm a big promoter of the universal basic income. I'm a big promoter of the fact that, all the abundance that is currently created through technology, should be used to have everyone on the planet benefit. So this is the smart way, and it can be done. And if you look at, the waste, transportation as a service, people don't need to drive their own car. I'm sure there are people who want to own a car, but most people want the transportation. They want the service. They don't want to own a car that's, gets parked all week, or all day in the streets. So transportation as a service, using the technologies that we have, batteries and so on, energy, as I said, and also food. So, and if you look at the technological advancements that we currently have, with the precision fermentation, cellular agriculture, we are able to reduce up to 90% of the CO2 emissions alone by transforming these through three sectors of the society: transportation, energy, and food. It's all possible. And so with that, we would be able to reach carbon neutrality by 2035 and go beyond that, toward carbon sequestration by 2040. So it's all there. It's all available. We don't have even to invent new technologies. We just need to decide and have the political will to move in that direction. And this is where I am supporting entrepreneurs like you, young people who come with those ideas. And, this is what I do. This is my passion.
Yeah, I think this is also some very interesting points. And in those, I think what is important always for us to remember what I sometimes think I'm missing in a way is also the thinking of not just the global thinking, because there are people who then sit there and publish a report and say, this is a way we have thought we can do it, or we might be able to do it. But to also think to keep looking at local landscapes, at regional landscapes, to maybe say, okay, how did people once live here in a way that we can combine it with the modern, to say we can bring back knowledge that has been lost, or especially as you mentioned Africa, for example, you know, people there have had a rich culture. I mean, some places still have it, maybe some smaller communities, but through globalization and also obviously colonization, there's so much of that knowledge, of that way of living, of knowing how to support yourself in that landscape that you are in those communities that you're in, has gotten lost and has maybe even been forbidden, you know, by way of telling
imperialism
people, yeah, of speaking a different language, and then basically losing all the things that were supporting, were the basis of your life, and then externalizing that. And so I think the conversation around that is, it's, I think there's so many nuances, and I think it's important to keep those and to say, okay, in this globalized world that does exist whether we like it or not, we may need these big frameworks where we say, okay, in like this, obviously it's also a very westernized way of thinking, you know, other people may think differently. And then also saying we have this as a framework and we know we can do it. As you said, the technologies, the knowledge, the expertise, it's all there. But also saying, okay, local communities and like a local regional type of thinking where you say, okay, people have knowledge, you know, on the ground, grassroots movements, and then maybe trying, okay, how can we combine that? How can we work side by side and listening to different angles? But I think these smart ways are very interesting. And I think, you know, as you mentioned also with renewable energies, obviously some people are having, there's these thoughts about, you know, also batteries, lithium mining, because I mean, mining obviously is a very intensive practice that destroys landscapes. And also the thinking of, can we, in this way that we're living now with continued growth and also, you know, the need for energy as well is rising, is not just kind of, instead of using fossil fuels, now using renewables, but can that still support, you know, even this growth that we have in the demand for energy? So saying not just switching the energy source, for example, but also saying we're changing the ways we consume energy, changing the way we're living our lives to actually consume less and need less. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I believe that in history of humanity, people will have never used less energy because of evolution. So providing, using the sun as an ongoing source of energy is actually the smart way. So I think it requires a lot of interior mindset transformation for people to decide not to do things. And I think most people don't have the luxury to make those decisions. So because most people are lower, you know, at the bottom of the pyramid, there are more people, and you know, everyone is born at square one, you know, even the Dalai Lama was not born enlightened. And so it requires a lot of evolutionary steps and consciousness evolution in order to make the conscious decision that I actually need less. Mm-hmm. So, and I personally, I don't think it works if, you know, if politicians go around saying, oh, you know, I have, you know, had the privilege to have this house and that and the other, and you please don't eat any meat.
Yeah.
It's just... So it's I don't know how practical, you know, that is. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very difficult. It's a difficult call, and mm-hmm. I don't think people would. It's human nature. So I think we need to work within this frameworks of human nature, and when it comes to energy that is available and the technology that is available and it can be provided, for instance, just to give you a number, because I'm a big believer of. The universal basic income. there are many organizations and scientists who have calculated that in order to provide everybody on the planet with the basic resources, transportation, food, energy, shelter, you know, we only need $250 a month, which is nothing given, you know, the technology that exists today at zero carbon emission. And so within that framework, I think it would be a pity to tell people, you know, use less, because we can give it to them. They can study, they, you know, study on the internet, everything is available, schools, you know, we have shelter, 50 square meters per person, transport as a service, as a a subscription, you know, as much as you want every month for 250. So I think it's this is something that we should be looking forward to and working toward, rather than tell people to eat, you know, no meat on Fridays. Mm-hmm. It's just my personal opinion.
Yeah. And I think because this was already like so much information, and I really hope that people will read your book. As I said, it's going to be down below so people can read a little more about your thoughts, which I think are definitely, as I said, thought-provoking, very interesting. And you've given also me things to think about, which I love. That's, you know, another perk of the podcast. So to kind of end this for now, I would just like to know, as I said, go a little more into the emotional, personal side, because it is an emotional topic. What is your personal relationship to nature? How do you see, how do you relate to it? Do you feel you're an active part of it in your everyday life? What are your feelings towards just the natural world and Earth with all its beauties?
I have been meditating for 43 years, and it's not my relationship to nature. I am nature. We are nature. I am not separate from nature, and I think this is very much related to the definition of consciousness, and you know, my understanding of consciousness. And this is going to, I mean, I'd rather not continue, because that would probably be misunderstood. You know, we are divine beings that have a certain raison d'être on this planet and help evolution evolve. And this is not all there is, you know. And I personally, you know, because I am part of nature, I am nature, I know that I am the product of whatever was before the Big Bang. And so as such, this is what gives me a lot of hope and the conviction that I am on a mission to contribute to whatever is the mission in life, and make, you know, evolution worthwhile. And I think, you know, we have all the opportunity to be happy. And if we awaken to what it means to be happy, and if we associate happiness with things rather than with a deep, deep spirituality, which indigenous people are so well connected with, then we can regard all of this as a wonderful game that we are all invited to play, and we shouldn't take ourselves nor the game too seriously. So I don't know whether I answered your question, but I don't believe in a regular IQ, because that's a very limited measurement of who we are. I am not my IQ. I am not my name. I am just the observer, you know, the player who's playing this game called life. And that is very empowering, and I think that we're all invited to play this game of, you know, making each other happy and contributing to making the world a better place and watching ourselves while this is all happening. So I don't know, this is very metaphysical explanation, but this is the result of sitting for 42 years on a cushion.
Also, I want to acknowledge and honor Indigenous and First Nations peoples as custodians of most of planet Earth's biodiversity and bearers of ancient knowledge. I pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and recognize all Indigenous and First Nations peoples' strength, resilience, and deep connection to nature. Thank you.